This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcast and entertainment industry. Now, today I'm very lucky. I'm speaking with Christchurch-born, Auckland-based production guru Chris Howe. Chris grew up in the Garden City, and from the beginning, he was already showing himself to be ready to take on the challenges of handling very big productions. From the small stage as a lighting technician to now handling major television productions, Chris has worked across many formats and has been a crucial part of some of the biggest shows to hit New Zealand screens over the last few years in his role as head of productions at Imagination TV. And I've been lucky enough to snag him for a chat on a very early Saturday morning. So thank you so much for this, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jamie. Gosh, quite an intro. I've been lucky. I've had a lot of opportunity and really interesting roles, and it's seen me get where I am today, I guess.
And the thing that I've always found interesting about your journey, and I guess in my sense as well, our journey, is we've always been in the periphery of each other. We went to the same high school together, we went to the same university, we're actually in the same year as well, and we were just talking about the fact that it's been a while since you've not returned to Christchurch. I think that was a conversation we had a couple of weeks back when I was proposing that you come on to the show. And as a starting sort of question, because you've been spending a few years in Auckland now, what are some of the things that you miss about living in Christchurch, and what are some of the reasons that you've decided to stay in Auckland? Because I'm sure there's many on either side.
It's tricky, Jamie. When I was in my sort of prime teenage years, there wasn't a city. There wasn't anything that we could, you know, this was after the earthquakes and all the rest of it. We were at uni after the earthquakes, you know. So it's hard to look back at that time and think that I missed out on anything. But when I do get an opportunity to go back, my parents aren't in the same family home that I grew up in. So that's, you know, unfamiliar territory where they live now. But I enjoy going back and seeing my friends that I still have down there. And it's funny, you drive through the city, although none of it really makes sense to me anymore. There's no landmarks or anything like that. You drive through the city and you remember your childhood down there. You remember when you couldn't drive and you walked everywhere. And in Christchurch, you can do that. You can walk from one end of the city to the other. Yeah. No, when I do get down there, I do enjoy being down there, but I can't stay down there for long. Auckland is certainly where I'm better fitted. The move to Auckland at the internship level, of broadcasting school, was the decision I had to make to get work. There is nothing down there for me to get work in. And so, yeah, no, there's certainly no looking back, but I do enjoy going down to have a little visit. Very rarely, I must admit.
Definitely, because Auckland always seems to be a career choice for a lot of people that work in broadcasting. And are you finding that those opportunities are sort of expanding outside of Auckland? Because I've noticed there has been a gradual shift where more and more films, like on-set production, is being done in the South Island. Like, we're seeing stuff growing in Queenstown in particular. Do you think there is a possible chance that opportunities will grow outside of Auckland? Or do you know, no, it's always going to be the main metro. Auckland will still be dominant. There's never going to be any chance that it could shift elsewhere.
I'd like to think it will shift elsewhere. It's tricky, you know, we're seeing with production companies just opened a little studio down in Queenstown for one of their recent productions, and which I think got a second round of funding and ended on there. You know, that's amazing for that region, but their basis, that company's base is still in Auckland. You know, the networks are up here from a TV perspective. The networks being the channels, but also the networks of people. It would take a fair chunk of trained sort of people, different roles to build, to expand the industry more permanently in other regions. But look, it's not impossible, and there's no reason why it shouldn't happen. But yeah, no, I'm not sure that I'd say it will anytime soon be a permanent expansion. We're just lucky to live in a country where we can go and take advantage of multiple different backdrops and locations on our back doorstep, really. We often will travel for a big show somewhere out of Auckland, but in terms of a base, not sure.
That's perfectly understandable, because I think this is the misconception that I get from a lot of friends who work overseas. When they think about the New Zealand film industry, they assume that it has this big market everywhere and it's not just based in one city. It kind of reminds me of the whole idea of how in the UK, London is such a hub for film and television. And obviously you might have the minor ones like Manchester and other places like that, but yeah, New Zealand doesn't have that luxury. And in terms of other things that I feel we need to touch on is the classic Christchurch question, which is always, what school did you go to? And you and I happen to go to the same school. As a fellow Kashmir High alumni, I do have to ask, did you ever step on the sacred lawn? And do you think the rumours are true that there is possibly principles buried under that lawn?
Buried or ashes spread or something was the rumour, right? I did step on it. It might have only been a corner. I can't say that I, you know, ran to the middle or anything, but I definitely did step on it. And I remember someone's ashes being said to have been spread on it. Maybe that's why it always looks so lush.
That's a good point. Very valid point. And it's quite Kashmir is quite an interesting wee beast in itself, because there's quite a few artistic people that have come through the Kashmir sort of hallways. And it kind of moves to another question I have, because I'm interested in where you got the interest in broadcasting, or in particular the interest in the entertainment sort of space, because a lot of people usually have friends or family that worked in the industry. Was that something that you had growing up? Did you have mentors or influences when you were younger, or no, it was something that was completely foreign to you and you kind of just jumped into it? Because yeah, it seems from what I've experienced from looking at you that you didn't really have that sort of background. It was something you kind of just developed over time.
Yeah, this is Kashmir. You've asked it at the right time. Kashmir was a huge turning point for me. I wanted to be an architect, and and I studied my first 3 years of high school, 2 or 3 years of high school, focusing on being an architect. So it was all about, you know, tech, drawing, graphics, art, all the creative mediums and subjects that I could take while still having to take the compulsory subjects. And in my weekends, I wasn't a popular kid. I hung out with, you know, we were this odd little clique of group that I was in, and we'd make films and random stuff in our weekends. And I had a really good friend in high school, and him and I would just literally, we wouldn't have scripts, we wouldn't have anything, we'd just go out and wing it in the weekend, sit down and edit scenes together, laugh and have a good time. And I am not a big reader. I don't enjoy English, or I didn't enjoy English in high school. I was like, oh god, another book I have to write and bloody essay on, you know. Got other things I want to be doing in my weekends and after school than reading a book. But my English teacher was one of my favourite teachers. So my friend and I had made this film, and we were playing it down on one of the, you know, big old fat TVs that sat up in the corner of the English rooms one lunchtime. And our classrooms all linked together in the big blocks. There were doors in between all the classrooms. And unbeknownst to us, another teacher was standing in one of those doorways from his classroom, watching over our shoulders. And when it finished, he said, "That was really good. You're kind of making stuff at like a year 13 level. Have you considered media studies?" And I went, "No." And he goes, "We can get your English credits for university through media studies instead of English," you know, in front of the English teacher. I went, "Oh, that sounds quite good." And, you know, I get to watch films and write about films and make films and get my English credits. And he said, "Well, yeah, from year 10, you can take media studies and do it that way. So I went, oh, okay. So I signed up for year 10 and did media studies. Then I kind of dropped all of my architectural focus and started focusing on something that I really loved. And, you know, it's funny, I come from a family of builders and practical people. So
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first stepfather, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I've got a builder as a grandfather, a builder as a father, a fencer and farmer on the other side of my family. And I said to my nana one day, I went, Nana, I'm not going to be an architect. I'm going to make films. And she goes, no, you can't make any money making films. No, not sure about that. And I went, no, it'll be all right. I'll, you know, go to broadcasting school or something. I'll, you know, it's this great school I've heard about. And then I'll move to Wellington and I'll, you know, work for Peter Jackson. And she, that didn't go down so well. But anyway, all these years later, she was my biggest fan and watched everything that I made that went on TV. So, yes, I didn't really come from a background in the industry at all. And I did change paths pretty quickly, thankfully, and sort of stumbled into it thanks to really great teachers that identified a skill that I had and put me in the right direction.
Do you mind me asking, who was the teacher that pointed you in the right direction? I'm just curious as to whether I might have known them.
Yep, Mr. Brentzel.
Oh, okay. Very nice. Very nice. And it's interesting how young mentors or having mentors at that young age can be so influential in what choices you made, because I was in a very similar position. And mine was actually Mr. James, who was the media studies teacher at Kashmir for my year 13 and year 12. And he was actually the reason I went to broadcasting school, because no one told me it existed. And until
that's
that
right.
Point,
and so Mr. James was my media studies teacher once I finally took it. And that man is a gem. He's you know, kooky man, you know, and I wasn't the sort of student who go, oh yes, I'm going to make a documentary because that's what you've told me I need to make. No. I've written a film, it's period drama, and I'm going to Ferrymead to film it with the steam train and all the costumes. And he was just like, okay, off you go.
But I love how you're already immediately ambitious at that point, because I feel like that's sometimes a thing where a lot of people get turned away from media or doing anything of a creative sort because they just think about the realism, the reality, and being like, I don't have the budget to accomplish this. I don't have the ability to do this. Whereas, and you're just taking it by the horns and being like, bugger it. I'm just going to try it, see what happens. And if it's good, it's good. Like, and I love that approach, because I feel like that's what keeps a lot of people out of this industry, is the fear of like, oh, what if I make something bad? It doesn't matter. As long as you're making something, I think that's the crucial point.
Yeah, my films were always terrible. You know, that period drama film that I made for, I think it might have been a year 13 project. I think everyone had to make a documentary or something, and they, you know, they made them on BMX riders or something happening and God knows where. And I went, oh God, that's so boring. And I don't want to do that. And so I wrote this script with a friend of mine, and literally no budget, you know, but I didn't let that hold the creativity back. And I think that's where I think that was my first experience in production, so to speak, where I was on the phone to Ferrymead asking if they'd let me film at the Heritage Park. I was running around bloody secondhand stores with $5 in my back pocket trying to buy ex-army uniforms. I wanted to use this song at the end credits, which is a, you know, Sony Music song or something. So I'm emailing Sony going, I'm a student, I want to use this song, I need to get permission, you know.
Wow.
All at the age of whatever, yeah. So I think that was, you know, that, and that film, I think, got me into broadcasting school.
That's incredible that already you were thinking about the semantics of what goes into a production. Like, did you have like a book that you'd been reading being like, yeah, I need to get clearance on this song from Sony. Like, it may take me 6 months, but I'm willing to wait. Like, how did you even have the forethought at that point? Because sometimes that's not even things that most people making amateur films would even consider at that point.
I can't really remember, but I think Mr. James probably said, well, unless you get permission, thinking I probably wouldn't. Unless you get permission, you can't be using that. And I love a challenge, and if anyone challenges me, off I go. I'll get it.
I'm sure your stubbornness will become something that will become a point probably later in the conversation, because I remember you at broadcasting school, and I remember that being like a trait of yours, that you didn't take no as an answer. Like, you were going to keep doing something until it was done, which I loved. And it's almost reflective as well of you moving into lighting, which is really interesting, because you did a lot of like work, early work in the theatre space, like being a lighting tech for the Aurora Centre in Christchurch, as well as being a tech for a local lighting firm. So a question I have for you is, what are the key components that you need for good lighting in theatre, and do you shudder still now when you see it done poorly?
That was like a teenage weekend, you know, job for me, and it was so many years ago, I probably couldn't tell you what it takes to get good lighting. I mean, interestingly though, a lot of the key principles follow through into when you're lighting for television. You know, a key and a fill and a back, and you know, but I grew up as, you know, that outcast gay, loved going to the musical theatre performances, you know, kid. My mum's best friend, she owned a dance school and choreographed all of the big showbiz shows in Christchurch. And so we were always at the Isaac Theatre Royal watching the big, you know, Cats performance, you know, Miss Saigon, all of the big sort of Broadway musicals that were put on locally. And I was always just absolutely blown away by the magic of it, the lighting, the effects that they created, the whole experience, as well as obviously the talent on stage. And it was at her end of year recitals that eventually my sister ended up dancing in, that my mum had sort of said, oh, he'd love to come and work on your end of year recitals, you know. And I idolized Mandy. And you know, sadly she's not with us anymore, but I absolutely idolized her and looked and thought she was just so incredible. And she said, yeah, I'll get him some form of role working with the Aurora Centre on my interview job. So I was follow spotting, never done it before in my life, follow spotting from the roof rafters of a theatre. And that's how it kind of all started. And it was just a bit of fun. And I didn't know whether it was anything I wanted to do, but I could earn a little bit of money.
But it's interesting that even then you were kind of getting into even the on-set side of things. Even though I know theatre is a completely different beast, you're still treating it in the same sort of way. And in terms of now, do you still have quite a soft spot for musical theatre, even in the later years?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Wicked last year. I mean, I know it was a movie, but musical, going to be a musical any day.
No, I completely understand that. I agree with you. Wicked was actually fantastic. I've seen the live show in London and seeing the film. I was like, you know what? It competes. I'm not sure about the whole like second part movie sort of scenario, but I'm here for it. I was thinking it.
They've used a lot of the music already. I'm very concerned.
And I wanted to touch on something else that you mentioned, because I feel like, one, it's a reflective of kind of my background as well, especially during high school, and probably for a lot of people that get into film or any sort of like media-based industry that's a bit more creative, the whole idea of being an outcast. Do you feel like that almost plays a part into where you ended up being on the more creative side of things, because of the fact that, like, it's almost like because you have more time to yourself, you're more retrospective, more introspective, and you kind of think about things a little bit more and want to try things out? Do you feel like the outcasting in a way actually played it to your advantage, because you were like able to kind of express yourself in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, my group of friends, some were super English and drama, some were, you know, a bit more this, a bit more that, and whatever else. And I was very focused on visual art. And I don't know that I necessarily expressed myself through it, but it was my happy, safe place. And when I didn't feel confident enough to go out in the rugby fields or whatever, I felt most comfortable when at home in an art class, drawing in the computer lab of the graphics department, designing shitty houses or some whatever I was doing, you know. You know, when the flat roofs, when the tilted flat roofs became a thing, every house had to have, you know, multiple angled tilted flat roofs. And then, you know, photography ended up being a subject that opened up for me. You got, you know, different subjects at different stages of your high school career. Then I was a darkroom technician, and I was like, you know, taking photos on film and processing. And
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long distance relationship, becoming a first step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Fixing chemicals, and it was a little group of us at lunchtimes, and you know, if we could get off PE to do an art assignment, we would. And it was, yeah, my creative outlet in different ways: digital graphics, photography, painting, whatever.
And speaking of photography, you actually used to collect vintage cameras, and I'm pretty sure you still do. And you kind of dipped into a little bit. There we go. I see. Gotta love that. In your background, which no one else is going to see because we're recording on the audio, but here's a massive shelf full of vintage cameras. And you dipped into doing a little bit of analog photography as well. So was that kind of like something you have still maintained now, but it was something that was birthed even at that early point? Is it kind of something you always love to kind of dip into every now and then?
Yeah. You didn't get a choice in high school. You had to start learning on film because it teaches you the fundamentals of exposure and camera settings. And then you go into a dark room and you learn to develop and then print and gain another level of exposures and timings and whatever else. And my mum and dad gave me a beautiful, and it's up there in the top corner, a beautiful old 1914 Kodak foldable camera for Christmas or something. And I just, it was an ornament, you know, it just looked nice in my room. And then mum kept buying me new vintage cameras. So she was like, "Oh, he likes these, you know, they look great, cool, yeah." And I did. And they were always on display, and they came up to Auckland with me when I moved. And then I got given my grandfather's film camera, a beautiful Kodak, and I thought one day, I'm going to see if I can get these things working. And so I cleaned them up, dusted them off, and sure enough, I got everyone working, and the addiction sort of crept from there. I kept every, you know, week I'd come home with a new film camera, and my partner would be like, "Oh God, another one," you know. And but it was fun, you know. Film would come out incorrectly, and I sort of was just trying to. There's something magic about picking up something that's so old, you know. For any a camera ranging from 1914 through to 1994. Picking up something that's so old that still works and imagining what images this lens has captured in the past and whether I can get it working. They all have their own quirks, and, you know, it's great fun. It's great fun.
And sometimes the imperfections actually make the photos even better. Sometimes it plays to your advantage, yeah, and makes something that's even more interesting than probably what it originally was meant to capture.
That's right. That's right. There's absolute magic in them. And they just, the photos have, even if they are, you know, scanned digitally, the photos just have this beautiful grain and texture and depth and life that a digital camera just can't give you. So, yeah, it's my little pastime if I have time.
And so you moved from the safe space of Kashmir High School in the media studies room where you were doing small films and short films, and then went to attending the New Zealand Broadcasting School. And it's kind of weird because you're already working in the industry while you were also attending Broadcasting School, because you're working as a production assistant as well as working in vision switching as well. How did you manage to balance the obligations you had with studying as well as also basically working these very intensive roles, like, and you're basically living and breathing the industry at all times? Did it not become exhausting to you, or is it something that you just felt like, this is where I exactly where I want to be, and I don't matter, it doesn't matter to me if it's 24/7, I'm in TV?
Yeah. I hadn't quite got to vision switching. That was my internship, but I was doing some PA stuff with Whitebait Studios down in Christchurch. My broadcasting school life was very busy. I had a job at the time as a digital designer or something. I grew up as a St. John cadet, and it was something that I did in my spare time and my weekends, or, you know, every Tuesday after school or work. And that evolved into being employed by St. John and creating a in-house production company where we, instead of the charity going out and paying marketing companies with a markup on their product or their services, we were employed to create the marketing material, the educational material for paramedic trainings and whatever they needed in-house. And they paid us our hourly rate, and we created everything in there. And that was, my office for that was only just down the road from broadcasting school. So I would go and park my car at work, walk to uni, do a day at uni, walk back to the office, do 4 or 5 hours of work, and then get home and do anything I needed to do for homework, write an essay or whatever it be, and rinse and repeat. So yeah, I lived and breathed the creative television, creating, filming, designing, whatever, through those years of B-School.
And was that an opportunity you created yourself? Did you approach the team at St. John, or did they approach you knowing that you were going to broadcasting school and being like, this is the perfect opportunity to get someone who's young, knows what they're doing, is like wet behind the ears, but also can offer like a fresh perspective? Is that kind of how it came about? Or was it you were aggressively going in and being like, you know what, I know I can make this better than probably some marketing agency who's going to double the price?
Not quite. What happened was, obviously, I'd been in St. John from a very young age and had a great group of friends outside of high school. Obviously, this was my sort of social group. And the earthquakes had happened, and our schools went to half days. We shared our campus with another school, and so I had afternoons free. And a very good friend of mine, Paul, from St. John, he had started already in a small scale this in-house production company, and I'd kind of done the odd thing helping him with cameras or setups or whatever, and I had a friend that was working alongside him. And then once the earthquake thing happened and our school went to half day, he said, well, do you want a job for the afternoons? And so that's how it started. And then I'd already been working with him for couple of years, sort of in those afternoons or when school went back to full time, after school if I could. And then I said, oh, I'm going to go to broadcasting school. And he actually said, do you really want to go to broadcasting school? Do you really need to? I'll keep you employed. No, I need to. And so he made it work that I could still work with him or for him whilst I was at B school. And then, you know, the next milestone came when I'm moving to Auckland. Oh, well, I can still send you work remotely to Auckland. I was like, yeah, that's cool.
You're like, yeah, I'll take it. Why not? In a way, it's almost like for many people, the earthquakes kind of removed a lot of opportunity because there was a lot of like work that kind of left the city after the earthquakes, but you found more opportunities, and actually it was an advantage to you. That's incredible, because I think I didn't even realize you were doing so much. I was aware of some of the stuff you were doing outside of broadcasting school, but I didn't realize you basically had a full-time job. Well, not a full-time job, but you get what I mean. Once you graduated, and so you had this internship in vision mixing, was that something that you quickly realized was not where you wanted to be, or was it kind of a situation of you still were yet to discover what your true calling was? Because I feel like in television and film, it does take a while for some people to kind of go through the throes of being in the position where they're like, I know exactly where I want to be. It's almost like a discovery point. Was that the same situation with you with this internship?
Well, if we wind back to sort of starting broadcasting school, and, you know, broadcasting school for me, being an outcast in high school, or not an outcast, but I just wasn't cool. I wasn't cool. I wasn't popular, you know, anything like that. Didn't matter to me. Didn't matter. But I saw broadcasting school as my chance to reinvent myself. You know, I wore glasses in high school. I got contact lenses for broadcasting school. I went in there going, no, this is where I'm going to be me, 100% me. And then sort of with that internal confidence, I was like, I'm going to be a studio director. And, you know, everyone wants to be a director. You don't go to broadcasting school because you've got a dream of being, you know, anything other than a producer or a director, really. And it's delusional as all hell, but it's at the age that we go in there, that's what we are driven. And it's good drive. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's good drive. But I was lucky enough that Richard Hanson really took a shine to me, and I got more than most chances to sit in the director's chair in the studio. And so for me, I wanted to be a studio director, a multi-camera live or as live studio director. So vision switching as an internship, and we can talk about how I ended up there, because I could have gone many directions even at that point, was as close as I was going to get as an intern to sitting with a director, to being in the hot seat in a control room. So that's how I ended up in vision switching.
And because I noticed this very early on when we were at university together, I noticed that tenacious sort of spirit, like you said, the confidence. Did it take a while for you to kind of slip into it in a way that you felt like comfortable in it? Because I feel like I sensed that you were kind of there to prove yourself in a sense. Like I always got that impression from you, and not in a bad way, but in the sense where you knew what you wanted. You wanted to get it that way. And do you feel like it took a while for you to slip into that? And do you still find yourself in that situation even now at work? You don't feel like, because this is the big thing in everyone, and I know it's a trendy word, but imposter syndrome, was it kind of like you were trying to fit mm-hmm. into this role and mm-hmm. you finally fitted into it, or did you feel like it naturally just happened?
No, imposter syndrome is still something I have a little bit of today, and I put on a brave face going, you know, those first few weeks at broadcasting school. But inside I was freaking. I was like, oh my God, I need to make friends. I need to, you know, it's an intimidating environment. You've got people that have come from anywhere, all over the country, people that already know each other. You have acquaintances that you already kind of know or have heard about. And now you are going to be in this pressure cooker of a university for 2 years together, working on top of each other. If you fall out, like God. But very quickly, little cliques and groups started, and I was lucky enough to have some really great people in my class. I work with a couple of my, you know, ex-broadcasting school classmates in different capacities over the years. And you know, we are now like a family, but at the time, yes, I was freaking. I was like, oh my God, I need to not be cool, but I just need to, like, not overdo it, keep chill, be likable, but be confident, you know. And yeah, I did all right.
In terms of the internship, as you said, it wasn't always where you originally planned. And why is that? So, and I'll give context to people that maybe, because I don't think I've even given context to the process of the broadcasting school, but the broadcasting school, you go for 2 years, you do your study, you find what you want to specialize in, and then from there, ideally, you want to be trying to find an internship that suits you. And you can go one of two ways. You can either find your own internship, or maybe the tutors can point you in the right direction, or someone will headhunt you during that process. So for you, Chris, what happened during that process? Did you have an offer that you went for? Did you have something that the tutors put you forward for? Or was it something like you had a couple of offers, you were like, no, that's not the one I want. That's not the one I want. I want this one. Or what was kind of what happened with you in that whole scenario?
So, and I think you as we talk more, you'll pick up a theme that I've always had people around me that either pointed me in the right direction or guided me or being there alongside me. And one of the last things you do at broadcasting school is a final project. And I wanted to, in line with my studio, being a studio director, do multi-camera scripted studio directing. And so typical me, email Shortland Street and ask for some scripts. And so I email Shortland Street and I go, I want to do this project. My project is not about the story. It's about my process in directing. So to save me the hassle of writing, can I please have some scripts that have been to air, you know, 3 or 4 scenes. It won't go anywhere, blah, blah, blah. Sure enough, here's some options with some different storylines. They send through a few scripts and I pull out the storylines that I want to include in my drama and sort of create this 3 or 4 scene, build a set, you know, everything. But during that process, I had a mentor, and we often all had mentors in that last sort of project. And my mentor, Anne Williams, who had been many years before the producer of Shortland Street, come time for internship hunting, she'd really taken me under her wing, and she said, what you're going to do is you're going to book a plane ticket to Auckland for 3 or 4 days, and I will help you send out letters or emails to the contacts that I have to try and have meetings to get an internship. Okay, Anne, let's do it. So I booked my plane tickets and had my dates, and she, you know, helped me secure some meetings. So I had a day with Shortland Street, South Pacific Pictures. I had a day at TV3, where at the time her daughter was working, so that was an easy in. She obviously had contacts at Shortland Street. And then I had another meeting with a company at the time. It was a new company that had just started up called NZ Live, which is now NEP. And so I get on the plane and I go up to Auckland and go to Shortland Street and meet the AD department and all these different departments. That was, you know, with my CV and everything, you know, and then go to TV3 and sit in the control room, watch the news, watch them do pre-recorded shows, whatever else, going, yep, cool, this is great. And then go to NZ Live and see this brand new shiny facility set up that was set up to service TAB racing stuff as well as external sort of casual clients. And then I flew home and sort of waited, you know, sent emails thanking them and all the rest of it. And an offer comes through from NZ Live to be an intern as a technical director / vision switcher, and read, you know, that contract and met great people along the way there and thought, oh, that looks good. What do you think, Anne? Yep, that looks good. You'll be sitting next to the director. And then, so I accepted it. I just went, well, I've got an internship. Let's just bloody take it. And then a couple of days later, Shortland Street emailed me going, we don't do interns, but we've created an intern role for you because we really liked you and would love you to come and work with us and be an AD and train to be an AD. And I went, fuck. Because that's really where I wanted to be, in that buzzy environment, and which is, you know, coming back to theatre live, you know, coming back into an environment which is buzzy like theatre. And so, you know, reluctantly I emailed and I said, hey, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. But I have to be honest, I had an offer come through and I've accepted it. But please keep me in mind if, you know, you need someone to fill in or you've got an opportunity, you know, after my internship's only 6 months, whatever. They were incredibly grateful for my response. And I ended up eventually doing casual work there. But my internship was with NZ Live, vision switching, right next to the director, learning really, you know, repetitive process, but it ingrained everything. So yeah, that's how I ended up there.
It's interesting because some people look at their lives and look at those forks in the road where they could have made one decision and been somewhere else. Do you look back at that decision now and see it as the best decision you could have made compared to maybe what some people would have said and been like, oh, that was the dream job at the time, but I went this different way? Looking back at it now, what's your kind of thought on that moment? Is it sort of like this gave you longevity in the industry by you switching to work with NZ Live because of the fact that you were right at the helm by the director's chair, kind of getting the ropes and the foundations that you needed to move forward? Or what was kind of like, looking back, what was your thought on that?
No, I absolutely still do occasionally look back at it and go, where would I be if I had sort of taken a different path? But although NZ Live's internship wasn't as maybe fun it was fun, but it wasn't as shiny and glamorous as what the ADing for Shortland Street would have been. The people, there was one person in particular that I met at NZ Live and got really close with, is why I am where I am today. So without that relationship that I formed there and the path that then took me on, you know, I'm incredibly grateful that I went the direction I did, but I do wonder where I'd be if I'd gone the other way.
Do you think, in a sense, sometimes the sexiest roles aren't always necessarily the best roles? Like, it's not always the best way for you to make connections and network? Because I've noticed this with a couple of people I've spoken with where they've done what are considered like the dishwasher job in the kitchen, and when you're working at a restaurant, like working the low-level job, but you get to meet some really interesting people who are old heads who have that knowledge and have that background that can point you in the right direction. Do you feel like that was kind of like what New Zealand Live was for you, NZ Live was for you, because you made this really good contact who just happened to know everyone?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even though it wasn't so shiny, I recognized the value of what I would have walked away, the universal skill that I walked away from that job with, or would have walked away with, even if it didn't last. And, you know, 6 months, you are only guaranteed 6 months, so you are always thinking, is it, you know, what's next, or where's this opportunity going to take me? And I'd seen a really valuable skill with not a big market for that, or not a lot of people in the market with that skill.
No, it's totally fine. And in terms of when you next moved on, because you obviously stayed at NZ Live for a little bit, but then you moved on to working with Imagination TV. And as I mentioned before, it's kind of like being, you can't just go straight to being the head chef in the kitchen. You sometimes got to start at the bottom. And was that kind of what happened with Imagination TV? And in a sense, do you feel like that's a good way to get into the industry and kind of humble yourself in a way, is to be on the proverbial ladder in the production world and start from the beginning and then work your way up? Do you feel like it kind of gives you a sense of earning your stripes compared to jumping in the deep end too early and then realizing you can't swim? How do you feel about jumping in at that point?
Yeah, it was the internship for 6 months got cut short to 3 months, and then I was employed on salary, right? And so salaries in television, a cushy place to be. You know, you're guaranteed, you've got sick pay, holiday pay, you know, public holidays, time and a half, all that sort of stuff. And the jump out of NZ Live meant I had to go freelance. And having gone from leaving home into an internship where I was guaranteed my pathetic amount of internship money a week to a salary paying job, I was feeling really good. I was like, yep, cool. Then there was a little step in between Imagination and NZ Live where my work at NZ Live was shift work, and so I could have night work, I could have weekend work and weekdays free, all sorts of stuff. It was all over the place. And during sort of days off, or if I had a night shift during the day, I was doing another job, and that was for a TV show called The Cafe on TV3. It was hosted by Mike Peru and Mel Homer. And they recorded 5 episodes on a Tuesday and rolled them out for the week. So on a Tuesday, I always tried to make sure my shifts were at NZ Live were in the evening. And I would go and assistant floor manage, the studio record days at TVNZ, even though it was for TV3, in the studio. I was in the studio, I was working. I was just constantly working. And then I'd walk back from, you know, downtown to Parnell, where I'd do my shift at NZ Live and go home and sleep. But I had that opportunity through the operations manager at NZ Live. Now, she's important in my story because she employed me at NZ Live on the internship. She cut my internship short and put me on a salary, so I was getting more money. And then she was also working as the DA on The Cafe and eventually left NZ Live to go and work full-time on The Cafe and took me with her. So I ended up, after a year or so at NZ Live, leaving to go freelance, where I worked for The Cafe, one studio record day a week, and every other day I was working from home or traveling, shooting the travel segments or the different VT segments, the out-of-studio content that we dropped into the show. Long story short, she ended up leaving the cafe and going to Imagination TV. A week later, she calls me going, you need to come and work at Imagination TV. So I go and do an interview at Imagination, scared shitless, because this is like a proper product. We're talking a proper production company now. We're talking like, you know, Rachel Hunter's Tour of Beauty, New Zealand's Got Talent, you know, big MasterChef, My Kitchen Rules, the, you know, original New Zealand series. I was like, wow, this is big. This is proper. So I go and do my interview, and it was for a show called Homemade, which was a home improvement show where we'd go into people's houses and they wouldn't know what we're doing. They'd go away, we'd renovate inside and outside. And so I was like, right, I've got builders in my family. I'm very practical. I'm very organized. I can do this. Like the role I was going for was, it had some fancy name, but really it was just a PA. It was I can't remember what it was now. It was like project integration manager or something. I don't know. Anyway, it was a glorified PA role where I was working with the interior designer, the builder, and the landscaper to sort of come up with their projects for each show, for each house, get all the supplies and have them all ready and manage the renovation for the show, right? And so I go in and I'm sitting here going, yeah, build it. Yeah, I know a lot about, you know, practical things. Yeah, can do that. No worries. Yep, cool. Walk out going, well, I hope that went well. And I get offered this contract for 6 months, only 6 months, but it was 6 months of an opportunity. And then I left the cafe and jumped ship to Imagination. And that's how I started as a glorified coordinator.
It's funny because the kind of stress that can be involved with freelance work can be a mix of exciting but shitting your pants at the same time, because you look at those deadlines of, like you said, sometimes it can be 6 month contracts, 3 month contracts. Is it something that, like, now that you're in the role that you're in now, is it kind of like you look back at that fond memory of looking at the days of being a freelancer, the kind of like roughing it to kind of get to the next contract? Do you look back on it kind of fondly? Because it is almost like in each job and each contract, you're proving yourself to get booked on the next one.
Absolutely. You're only as good as your last job. And, you know, your last job is what people will remember. And you 6 months, you know, come you're 4 months in, you start thinking, shit, okay, only got a couple more months, a month to go. You're going, okay, I really need to find something. That role for Imagination was 8 years ago, and I have had rolling contracts with them ever since. So I'm still actually a contractor, even as the head of production, I still have a contract that ends. So I still come a month to the end of my contract, have to go and have a conversation with the company owners and go, how are we feeling? Do you need more out of me? Do you want to change my role up? Do you want to, you know, it's still an ongoing thing, but the contracts have gone from 6 months to a solid 12 to 13 months. So I lock in for a long period of time, but that doesn't come without, you know, things I need to achieve or whatever. So it has always been a constant. What's coming next? Do I need to prepare for something? The benefit of your contract ending or coming to an end is it gives you a chance to reset, or it gives you a chance to better yourself. So you don't want to just roll from one contract, you know, as a coordinator to a next contract as a coordinator. Try and roll from a coordinator to something else, another level up. And so that's how each contract I've tried to improve or level myself up.
You might try and see if you can get a pay rise every couple of months, but you might get turned down, and even then you don't know whether you will get that senior management role compared to, yeah, as you said, the freelance role. I know these are the KPIs I can hit, and I know I can hit these other ones as well. Have you ever considered taking on, like, don't know, film, for example, because you've worked in television for so long, have you ever now looked back and been like, I know this is the scale I can work at. I know I can now work in a feature. Is that something that you've considered as well?
They're very different worlds. And I don't, you know, and I'm not blind to the fact that if I wanted to change the film, I would have to go back down. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I'd have to go back down to learning the ropes and that. It's similar to drama and television. You know, I've crafted my, you know, I've carved my career path in television predominantly at Imagination, where we focus on documentary, premium factual, reality. So those are the worlds I know. And if I was to jump ship into a different world, I know that I'd have to carve out a new path, which I'm not scared of. I just haven't needed to sort of consider it yet. And maybe the day will come. But for me, I'm still in that stage of, you know, what can I do next? Or where can I shift? Where can, you know, can I move sideways and try something different? So our industry has so many different directions and different roles, and it's full of opportunity. And I am very lucky to work at a company that is still New Zealand owned and operated. There's no international, you know, big daddy sitting over in Singapore or anywhere, you know, that we're answering to. I work for two very, very, very clever business and creative people who have actually been more influential to the New Zealand industry than many will realize. And I'm learning every day something from them. And they encourage and push me. They are just as driven to see me climb or grow or learn as I am for myself. So I'm not done yet, you know. I'm not done. I might be the head of production, but I'm directing episodes of Grand Designs. I'm, you know, fingers in all the pipes.
It's interesting you bring up a New Zealand-owned production company because, yeah, you're right, a lot are owned by Australian companies, American, Canadian, and for the such. What do you think is the main difference that you see from working from a wholly New Zealand-owned company compared to maybe some of your peers that are working for international companies, production companies that are putting stuff together?
I mean, I can't imagine we... I can't imagine that the internal vibe within their production office or their production houses is any different other than they've probably got some KPIs above, beyond their branch to meet. They also have the luxury of their owning their father company. They also have the luxury, I think, of their owner company having what they call a catalogue. So, you know, Banerjee, All3Media, you know, all these companies that have bought into New Zealand companies come with formats. And so those are shows like New Zealand's Got Talent, MasterChef, MKR. What else have we got? We've got The Bachelor, all, you know, Married at First Sight, all of these formats, international formats. So they're available to those New Zealand companies to make. Now, the difference is we don't have a catalogue-owning father company. We then have to buy the rights to a format from those companies. So if we want to make something that is from Banerjee, we probably won't ever be able to make it because they've got a company here that can make it. And they've already got some form of ownership in it. So everything we make is original, except Grand Designs, who is owned by Fremantle. But that, as hard as it is, you know, to get funded, because it's not a tried and proven format overseas, is more exciting because we're creating something from the ground up, where we've got full ownership, we've got a full creative process to create it, and the company they own it.
And for that, you've worked across a variety of different sort of formats in terms of reality TV, design shows, factual series. How do you think the approach changes from a production standpoint for you Is it quite significant, the changes, or do you feel like everything still fits into a relatively similar format? It's just the case from the creative process, it's a little bit different.
It's all about scale, I think. You scale in team sizes. So, you know, Grand Designs, for example, is something that we've been making, the company's been making for 10, 11 years. That takes a smaller team. That's a well-oiled machine. Ticks along, it happens. Bigger reality shows, big teams. We've got your production team goes from just a production manager to, you know, production manager, PAs, cohorts, line producers. You might have challenge or sort of date or whatever producers. You know, you scale up, and it just means more people to manage, more moving parts, you know. But it's all about just identifying, okay, this show is of this level, so it needs this scale team. This show, we can tick away at that internally with who we've got in the building. We might just employ one or two more people. So it's all about, yeah, scale.
And what do you think is the core thing that can make or break a successful series from a production standpoint? What are some of the things that you feel are the major pitfalls that people find themselves in when they're trying to create a successful series? Is it maybe investing too heavily into hiring too many staff and then it ends up being a management nightmare? Or is there a more simplistic term in terms of what will make or break a series in the production standpoint?
And I think your production team is absolutely crucial to the success and smooth running of a show. If you have a bad egg, if you have a ego-filled person in the team or whatever it be, that can derail things real quick. It is fundamental to have people that are open communicators, that are not afraid to make a mistake, because the beautiful thing about production is we're all working together for the same goal, and we will not watch someone fall off the edge of a cliff. We all have different abilities to be able to support, to be able to catch something before it falls. So the crucial thing to the success of a production from a production perspective is a harmonious production team. And I've worked on shows where there have not been harmonious production teams.
Because I was going to ask that, do you think that's a common misconception? Because I think when a lot of people think of producers and directors, they think of these hard asses that are screaming down the phones and trying to direct people where they need to go. Do you think that's often a common misconception, that a more fluid team that's happy working with each other and feels safer than the environment actually works better than a ball-busting producer rapping down the line?
100%. And from, you know, in New Zealand, I'd say it's quite rare to find one of those sorts of producers or directors. Having worked on another part of what Imagination does is we facilitate international companies coming into New Zealand to film. So we've had Pop come in and make X on the Peak, which is a winter version of X on the Beach for MTV. We recently, 2 years ago, had Helium come in from Australia and we facilitated them making Ultimate Escape. And, you know, when you have those international producers coming in, they behave differently. They behave how they would behave in their country, in their environment, with their whatever it is that they do over there. But here, Kiwis are too chill for that in television. Everyone gets stuck in, you know, it was interesting working with Americans because they're so unionized, you know, don't touch that lighting stand, that's not your department. Whereas we'd go, oh, we'll just try and move that out of the way, get that, you know, yeah, give that here, I'll carry it, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there are differences for sure, and there are those producers out there. I've not experienced them in television in New Zealand, but yeah. I think it is a common misconception that that's more the case than not, but no.
And now that you're in the position as the head of production, how early is it that you're coming into the creative process as well? Because as a producer, you need to think about the scale of the production, what the budget might be. Are you involved in that creative process as well in terms of determining what would be realistic or like will work for what you're putting forward? Or is that something that you come in towards the end, more or less?
I'm the first person engaged in any productions, obviously other than my bosses, but I write the budgets. I get the concept and I have to put on paper and money and size and scale from day one, what I think it's going to take to make that show, what sort of team I need to build, the scale of the team, how many camera operators, sound operators, drone operators, editors, everything, what facilities I'm going to need, what locations I'm going to need, everything. Absolutely everything. So I'm the first person engaged, and then I build the team.
And you talked about one of your mentors taking you along with her to Imagination. Do you feel like that's become quite a big part of the TV industry as well, as people find their little group or their niche of people that they end up working with on regular projects because they just know how they understand the flow, the work that goes in, and
it's
also kind of like the intricacies, yeah, and it's comfortable. Is it kind of like building a rugby team like the All Blacks? You find your forwards, you find your backs, and you're like, okay, I know these are my reliables, and then we might bring in some new crew to fill out the rest of the roles that we need. Is that kind of how you like to work as well?
Absolutely. Any department, camera, there's a, you know, camera group of different groups, but there's groups of cameramen that will always work together. There's groups of sound operators that always work together. Groups of art department people that always work together. From a production perspective, absolutely. You know, it comes back to building that harmonious production team. And if you're going into something stressful and you have worked with someone in the past that you know will be able to handle it or work well with in the environment that you need to create, of course you're going to go to the comfortable option. You know, then they might not be available, then you have to start looking elsewhere or whatever. And you can get it wrong. I've got it wrong. I've got some people wrong. Or I've inherited production teams from overseas that are totally wrong. You know, so it's not easy because everyone interviews as their best self, you know, and with that prior experience, working with someone is more valuable than people realize. And like I say, you're only as good as your last job.
And that's going to go to a question because we're going to move into the advice kind of area of things. Being a producer, working as a head of production, for people that are trying to get themselves onto productions like your own, Chris, what are some of the things that you feel are a major kind of bonus points or in your eyes would be something? You did say you're only as good as your last project. But are there other areas that people can really stand out when they're coming to you and being like, Chris, I'd really like to work with you guys at Imagination TV. What would be the thing that would make you look at a candidate and be like, you know what, I think you're worth like taking a shot on, even though I haven't worked with you before?
I think it can come back as early as me looking for an internship. If someone walks through the door rather than emails me their CV, then immediately I'm going to take them not more seriously, but I'm going to look at them harder and give them more of my time because they've taken the effort. And that's a hard thing to do, to walk through the door and go, hey, I just thought I'd pop in and say hi and meet you guys because I'd be really, you know, I've had that happen and I've gone, okay, that takes guts, you know. But other than that, if you're not in a position to be able to do that, and I'm not now saying, please come and bombard my office.
Everyone's just going to turn up on your doorstep now, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah. My boss would be like, why are these strangers coming in? No, please don't. Don't. Other than that, just I think if someone can say, this is what I'm interested in, this is sort of where I'd like to go, but I understand that I'm not going to be able to get there immediately. Is there any opportunities you could give me to sort of work alongside, like I worked alongside a director? You know, is there any opportunity that you might have available that you think would help me? Then I go, okay, this person's thinking about their career path. Let's talk and see if we can help you get there. Or, you know, there's nothing worse than, you know, someone new, but nothing worse. That's the wrong way to put that. There's nothing more uncomfortable, I think, from my perspective, look at having CVs come through for a job when they've not had more experience or any experience in that role. And that's not to say I wouldn't look at them, but it's uncomfortable. So the more you can do to ease my discomfort with someone being someone with no experience, the better. And what that is, I don't know, but ease my discomfort in going, you might be really good and you might have been a really great PA, meaning you will be a really great coordinator or whatever, but give me some examples that you would, how you would handle or how you have as a PA worked kind of as a hybrid co-ord. Give, even though your job list won't necessarily say co-ord, give me some, you know, I know I was a PA, but I really took my initiative to sort of help the co-ord or the production manager do this, and that made me realize that coordinating would be a really great next step for me, you know, that sort of thing. I don't think there's a huge place in television for ego. I don't like ego. I am very much a team player and want everyone to be a team player, not this out for my own, throw people under buses, you know, think I'm better than I am or anything like that. Be humble. Be humble.
And it's interesting that you bring up the whole idea of like evidence-based kind of experience, not necessarily just saying, yeah, here's my CV, here's what I've done, look at it, there you go. It's kind of like being able to back up what you're talking about and also taking the initiative to kind of go that step further. So it's kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying, like don't just be the person that just sends an email, go a little bit further than that, go beyond that to prove why you should be in front of me speaking to me and being like, hey, I really want a position with you, Chris. And when you look back on your own career, do you feel like that has always been at the backbone of kind of why you've got so far as you have, is just taking initiative? Do you feel like that's been a big part of it? It's like being the person being like, I'm not going to just wait for things to happen. I need to make things happen for me.
Yeah, or yeah, absolutely. Or ask if you're in a position, you know, ask, well, how would you feel about this being my next step? Or it's all about network. It's all about building a strong, not big, but a strong network. You can have a big network, that's fine. I don't have time to manage a big network, but have a strong network of your people, people that are in, will go into bat for you, people that you will go into bat for, because I'm walking proof that network has got me to where I am at the age of 30. And that's pretty quick. And yeah, I have imposter syndrome 100% in certain situations where I'm sitting there going, God, these people are twice my age, 20 years older, whatever. And this is all sitting on my shoulders. They must think I'm some jumped up young shit that's, you know, don't know, got to where he is somehow. The people that have given me these opportunities have had my back, believed in me, and sort of kept me up. And that's what I hold on to, the people that really matter to me and what I care about, not what everyone else is thinking. And I make mistakes, but I fall on my sword. You know, one of the first things they teach at broadcasting school, there's a technician in the television block called, his name was Lloyd, and he was all about, own the process. It's okay to make mistakes, but own it. Start to end, it's your process, you own it. And if you make a mistake, yeah, fucked it up. But here's how I'm going to fix it, you know?
Yeah, instead of trying to pass the blame and just move on or not accepting that you were in the wrong. I love that. And Lloyd, I really want to know where he's at. I miss him. He was a great shooter. He had a hell of a... He was very eloquent with his words.
I reckon it'll be like camping in a yurt somewhere down south or something, you know?
100%. Hiking. And I hope so.
That'll be what he's...
I would love to imagine that. I'm sure Lloyd found his happy place. But yeah, I absolutely loved him because he was very straightforward, straight to the point. Yeah. And yeah. I'm curious as well, because we've also talked about on the podcast before, like the style of relationships that you have when working in this industry, and your partner, does he work in industry? Is he in television, or no, is he completely outside of it? And how do you maintain that balance? Because working in television production is pretty full on as a job. Like, it could be a 24/7 job. How do you balance having a relationship and also being able to work in industry?
Yeah, no, my partner doesn't work in the industry. He's very creative and very clever, but doesn't work in the industry. He works in healthcare, and I'm very grateful that, you know, for jobs that I have had to travel for, sometimes for long periods, you know, during COVID, when no one could leave the country, I had left the country in Fiji for 3 months filming a series, and, you know, he was stuck at home on his own, unable to do anything. But so I'm very grateful that he allows me to go and do those things. But and you know, it's not easy. I come home at the end of the day. We both have very busy days. I come home and I'm like a dead, you know, log on the couch, wanting to just blob and watch TV or whatever. He's very understanding of that. And but you know, he like I say, he's very creative, so it works well in the sense that I'm able to support him with some of his creative stuff and teach him some things that I know, which is I enjoy, because it means that I get to sort of be a bit more hands-on with some tools that I haven't had to be so hands-on with recently. Yeah, no, we try, and every morning we're at the gym. Although we work out separately, it's kind of our thing. We go to the gym in the morning. At home, we, at the end of the day, we always update each other about our day. My days are, I wrote some schedules and, you know, did credit card reconciliations and, no. But, you know, it's not very exciting. But sometimes we get some exciting stuff across, and he mops up the stress mess that I can sometimes be, for sure.
You mentioned teaching things as well, and this is something that you're dipping into yourself, because your friends have regularly been asking you how you manage budgets and how you manage to basically pull together these large productions, which turns into them asking you how you manage your daily budget, which is something I can imagine you're incredibly good at, being a producer, being able to stick to very strict guidelines. And you've actually written a book about this as well. I'd love to hear more about it. How did this come about? How did the conversation with your friends come about? And why did you feel a book was the right move after having your friends badger you for this long?
I was encouraged to write a book about managing your personal and business finances as a sole trader. So, you know, 95% of our industry is operating by sole traders and contractors and self-employed people. And effectively, you are running a business. Even if it's just you, you're running a business. And so, you know, I have systems and things in place that help me manage that. And, you know, as simple as having two debit cards, one for personal transactions, one for business transactions. But, you know, tax time, GST returns, all that sort of stuff can be quite overwhelming for some people that don't have the mindset or you know, manage money on a regular basis. So, yeah, friends are always asking me, how do you do this? Should I do that? What about this? All that sort of thing. And one of them said, you should write this in a book, because you're constantly giving people advice, and I'm not saying I'm no financial advisor at the moment. The book is very New Zealand specific, but that's only around tax information and things like that. The general concepts and thoughts behind it can be applied anywhere, to savings, to ways to invest your money, have your money working for you, structures, budgets, things like that. And it's super simple, because I know that money can be overwhelming, very dense, use jargon and terms that make no sense. And so when I try and explain it to people, I draw a flowchart. So I've drawn a flowchart and put it in the book, you know, things like that, that just little tips and tricks, not dense stuff, not big chapters, just basic stuff that can help you structure your finances to make things easier. You know, we have a lot of people have fluctuating incomes. They have a busy month, they have a quiet month. So it's about setting up emergency funds and having buffers and all sorts of different things that can help you manage freelance life, so that your money is, you can have peace with you. You can be at peace with your money, knowing that you've got enough, you've put systems in place and things like that. So yeah, it's only 100 pages or something, like it's not huge, but I'm hoping that if someone needs it, that they grab it and learn something and sort of improve their financial management status with it. I don't know.
What do you think are the three key takeaways you take for any of your friends who always ask, like, Chris, how do you manage your money? What are your like key tips that you usually throw at them if you were to give them like a 30-second elevator pitch on how do you quickly save money or how do you maintain your wealth in a world where obviously avocado on toast is very tempting and obviously buying every subscription for every streaming service is always on the horizon as well. What's your classic tips that you go to, the 30-second elevator pitch?
Know your bare minimum costs. So what your bare minimum to run your personal life, but that your dream sort of, you know, avocado on toast on Saturdays is still okay. And know the bare minimums of running your business and your business expenses. Then keep a very clear line between the two. Don't blur the two. Don't mix the two. And then I guess what would be a third one? Know your bare minimums, set a budget, keep your business and personal expenses very separate. And if you're in a position to look at sort of higher interest savings accounts and things like that, then make the most of those because it might not seem like much, but it does add up once the interest starts rolling in.
Because, yeah, that's the thing. A lot of people get scared off in terms of talking about financials or saving, and they immediately think of stuff like the stock market, when in reality, just a high-interest bank account is a really good starting point for anyone who actually wants to understand how to make their wealth grow rather than it just sitting in a bank account where it doesn't do anything. So I love that. It's great advice. And if people want to get a hold of your book, how can they do so, Chris? And also, how can they get in contact with you if they want to learn more about like the great work that you're doing or to come and hassle you by turning up at your door at Imagination TV to drop off a CV?
The book is currently, as we're talking right now, only available on Kindles via Amazon, but in hopefully a matter of days, the paperback copy will be available to buy on Amazon as well. It's called The Sole Trader's Survival Guide to Money, a practical, no bullshit approach to managing your finances. So it's just in the title, basically. And I'll share it around on Instagram and things like that, and probably LinkedIn as well. In terms of getting in contact with me, LinkedIn is my professional way of contacting me.
That's brilliant. And I'll probably be putting show notes, Chris's link to his book, so you can check it out for yourself if you're wanting to learn some great money-saving tips, as well as also how you can get in touch with him via LinkedIn. But Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a trip down memory lane, including the sacred lawn in Kashmir, to the hallways of B School, to the lovely, what has been your career, television, which I'm sure is just going to be on the up and up, including the fact that, yeah, as you said, 30 years old, head of production, crazy. But I just have to say thank you so much, Chris, for the insights you've shared, and I have a very high suspicion that we're going to be speaking to you again very soon.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at BeyondBroadcastPod or via email at BeyondBroadcastPod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.